and welcome to the next episode of the podcast on negotiation. And today we have a very special guest with us, Josh Weiss. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Remy. It's great to be with you. I'm really excited to chat about this with you.
Thank you for joining us. Dr. Joshua N. Weiss is a co-founder. Now I'm reading out your short bio note. Is a co-founder with Bill Ury of the Global Negotiation Initiative at Harvard University and senior fellow at Harvard Negotiation Project. You are also a director and creator of the Master of Science in Leadership and Negotiation degree program at Baypath University.
Yes, all true.
All true. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this introduction?
No, I just enjoy getting myself into trouble with these different kinds of problems and challenges that we all face in the world. So that's pretty much it.
That sounds awesome. So, and speaking of trouble, this is exactly the topic of our today's discussion, because we're going to talk about failure. Failure in the context of negotiation, a super important topic, which I think for reasons that we will together explore, hopefully in our chat, is significantly underestimated, at least in negotiation pedagogy and probably also in research. So starting with setting the scene, what is a failure, Josh? How would you define a failure in negotiation?
You know, it's interesting because when I was thinking about this, one of the things that happened was that people said, you know, are you sure that there really is failure? Like, aren't we just talking about setbacks? And I said, well, maybe, but maybe not. Because I think there's a problem when we don't call something a failure, we're sort of denying perhaps the reality that's in front of us, right? So if everything's a setback, there's always a way to get back to the table. There's always a way to come back to a specific negotiation. And there are those opportunities in many ways, but there are other times where we do fail. And it's part of the negotiation landscape. I mean, you know, some of the problems and challenges that we all try to tackle are very difficult. And we can't expect to succeed all the time. And I think in some ways, part of why I wanted to talk about this is because I think it's realistic. Like, none of us sets out to fail, but we've all experienced it. I've never talked to anybody who negotiates who hasn't said, well, yeah, I've never had a negotiation that didn't go very well. Of course you have. So I just wanted to, in many ways, I wanted to start the conversation. And to your point, I think people are well aware of this reality, but we don't really talk about it. And I was sort of hoping to normalize the notion and say, what do we do with this when it happens?
Yes, that's a very important topic, I feel. When I was preparing for our chat, I sort of thought about failure that it's kind of independent of the negotiated outcome. So in some cases, we might not get a deal and feel that we failed and yeah. or succeeded. Yes. Right. And in some cases, we might end up with a deal and still feel that we failed and or succeeded. Yes. How can we recognize the demarcation line between failure and success if it doesn't depend on the outcome of a negotiation?
Well, let me say a couple of things. One is, you know, it's interesting because I've had the really great opportunity to talk to a number of hostage negotiation experts over the years and to work a little bit with them and to try to learn from them. And one of the things they always say to me is that for us, success or sort of quote unquote failure is actually about process, because we could do the same thing in two different negotiations. And in one, everybody comes out alive and things work out well. And then the other, the opposite happens. And so for them, failure is actually about process. And did they follow protocols? Did they, when things got difficult, did they communicate in a way that, you know, was able to engage the other and things along those lines? But to your point, you know, one of the things that I try to get at in the book is try to categorize failure a little bit for people and to say, okay, so what are some of the different ways that we can fail in negotiation? Kind of go a little bit deeper, right? We talk about failure, but like, what does that mean? And to your point, there are some negotiations where we reach agreement and we realize we shouldn't have.
Exactly.
Right? And then there are others where we didn't reach agreement when we could have. And I think those, and it's all about your underlying objective and your interest, right? And so if you reach an agreement that doesn't meet your interest, that's a failure. I was recently talking to a friend of mine who is in sales, and he was, somebody reached out to him and wanted, he sells fonts, believe it or not. And a customer reached out to him and said, we want to buy your font in perpetuity. Okay. And they typically, you know, they don't do that because it's not very profitable for them. But the guy was pushing him and pushing him to sort of give him a number. And my friend was hesitant, et cetera. And then eventually he did. And the range that he gave him, you know, the guy kind of quickly disappeared. And he came to understand that not only, you know, was the guy probably trying to use this as a way of getting some kind of a benchmark, because there isn't an industry standard for an in perpetuity font purchase. Right. So, but the point was, and he was saying, you know, I failed and I have to go back to my boss and tell him that. And I said, did you really? Because let's imagine that this guy had come back to you and said, so my, let's say my friend offered him the $5 to $7 million for an in perpetuity font. Okay. And let's imagine that the guy comes back to him, the prospective client, and says, we'll give you $1 million. Okay. Well, he could say yes, and he could reach an agreement, but that would also set a precedent. Right? And in that particular instance, it wasn't really profitable for the company. So, and he kept saying, I failed. And I said, did you really? Because in some way, I'm not sure you did in this case. I think in part, the other side was using the negotiation to sort of come up with a benchmark. But more to the point, if you had agreed to, you know, let's say they came back and said, we'll just give you $1 million. And you said, okay, well, I'll do that. Right? You just set a dangerous precedent that this actually isn't very profitable for your company, et cetera. Right. So a lot of it depends on, and for me, one of the most important things is when people say, how do you gauge failure? You know, it always comes back from my point of view to what is your objective in the negotiation as you define it? And if you didn't meet that objective, then that's a failure in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's what we have to talk about.
When I first heard about your intention to write a book, or the process that you were in the process of writing a book on failure, the first thought that that started buzzing in my head is that I wouldn't know how to teach anyone, you know, how to fail gracefully and wisely. As we don't do that as negotiation professors or instructors, we usually try to sell a message that usually is received or expected really very well and expected by our students, meaning we would like to make them more successful in life. Yes. Yeah. And sort of underestimate or underplay the frequency of failure, which they will certainly at some point experience. So why is it such a taboo topic? Is it only marketing or self-marketing or negotiation courses or negotiation professors? I don't want to be the professor who teaches failure. Yes. I want to be a professor who teaches success. Yes. Is that it? Or are there other reasons for it?
Well, let me give you a quick little story. So as I started to work on this book, I was meeting with one of my students and she said, well, what are you working on now? And I said, well, I'm sort of working on this book about failure and negotiation. And what do you do with it? Like, how do you really learn from it and cope from it? And she looked at me and she gave out a big sigh and she said, oh, thank God. And I said, well, why? Like, why do you say that? And she said, because everything we read is these amazing successes. And so we always feel like if we don't succeed in the way everybody in our books are succeeding, there's something wrong with us. And I said, if that's what we're teaching you, like, we're not doing a good job here. Like, we are misleading you to think that you're going to be able to achieve your objective every time. And it just doesn't work that way. So I think in that sense, what I'm trying to do a little bit is to humanize the process and say, look, we, none of us are infallible. And so we have to sort of say, if this happens, what do we do with it? And I think too often the problem is that we're so worried that it it's a reflection on us to the world that we want to run away from it quickly. And we worry what other people think of us. And I remember I went through, and I share the story in the book. I had a failure and I was dwelling on it. And one of my friends said, you know, when you realize that you're not nearly as important as you think you are, like, you're going to realize that everybody else has moved on. Almost nobody has noticed that you failed except you. And so, you know, let go of the pity, but think about what happened here and why did you fail? Like, why didn't this work out in the way that you imagined? He said, that's a much more healthy way of thinking about this than, you know, sort of wallowing in our sort of misery, if you will. But I think it's really important that that we do cope with it, because when we do fail or we don't get where we want to go, too often we push it aside very fast. I use the analogy in the book of kind of Goldilocks and the three bears, which is a very scientific analogy, but it's, I think it really does depict how people in negotiation deal with failure, right? So the too hot approach is basically where I do whatever I can to deflect and to preserve my reputation, right? So This had nothing to do with me. The other side was completely unreasonable, or the topic we were, you know, they came in bad faith, et cetera, right? That's the too hot approach. The too cold approach is, this is all my fault and I'm never going to negotiate again. Or if I am going to negotiate again, it's going to be, I'm going to have so much anxiety that, like, I probably won't ever succeed again. And then there's the bowl of porridge in the middle, which is, okay, it happened. We're not happy about it, but, like, let's actually take our time and think about, why did this happen? Really analyze it. Because I think the problem a lot of the time is people will say, boy, I learned a lot from that negotiation. I'm like, really, what did you learn? And when I dig in, they didn't learn that much. And when I start to say, are you sure? Because a lot of times what happens is people will say, I learned a lot. And then they want to take that and they want to apply it to the next negotiation that they're going to come to. And one of the problems with that is that we often are applying lessons from one negotiation to another, and the dynamics are really different. Their parties are all off and things like that. And so you have to be very careful in doing that. And you know, there's a woman, a professor at University of Maryland, last name is Catherine Bartol. And she said, when you've seen one negotiation, you've seen one negotiation. And the reason I like that is not because I fully agree that they're completely unique all the time, but it gives us pause to say, well, wait a minute. If they are, you know, if each negotiation is unique, what are the similarities and what are the differences? And so what can I actually transfer from one negotiation to another? And being very mindful and very conscious of the kind of lessons that you're trying to move from one to the other. One of the things that I have seen a lot from people in my trainings or students or people I work with is that they have an approach where they've succeeded and they think that they can just sort of apply that approach across the board. And I'm like, this negotiation is way too different than these others for you just to take what you did there and apply it here. And so I, in that particular instance, like, I'm really trying to get people to be a lot more discerning and to say, is this really the right lesson in this case? Or am I maybe in danger of applying something that isn't going to fit?
Exactly. So now that we've defined failure, so we know that it's a part of our life. I mean, 100% success rates in negotiations, it's not going to happen, right? I mean, tell us a little bit more about your book, Getting Back to the Table, 5 Steps to Reviving Stalled Negotiations. What was your intention? How did you think about your book helping negotiators understand and cope with failure or fail smartly?
I published a book a few years back called The Book of Real World Negotiations, and it was focused on successes. And I remember somebody saying to me, so this was really interesting. I really like it. Case studies, always valuable, blah, blah, blah. But why did you write about successes? And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, what do you mean? And they said, well, you know, I certainly, you know, love my successes, but I learn a whole lot more about my failures. And they said, you should write a book about failure. And I said, all right, well, let me think about it. And I thought about it and I thought, you know, let me just look and see what's out there on this subject. And on some level, I was surprised. Maybe I wasn't, because, in, you know, as I thought about it, I couldn't really recall too many, you know, works that were out there that really focused on this. And so there's some articles, there's some chapters, but I thought, okay, let's just devote a book to this. And more importantly, I think, let's talk about what happens when you don't call something failure when it really is. And also, so it's happened to you. Now what, right? It's the now what that's intriguing for me, which is how do I take this, really learn from it, and come out the other end a better negotiator? And I really genuinely think that you can, especially if you kind of, I mean, I have, as you mentioned, these five steps. And, you know, the first step in this is about coping and about dealing with it. And too often people are like, I'm just going to move on. Like, I'm going to blow past this without feeling the sting of missing out on my objective and what I was trying to do. So I spend a good bit of time in the book talking about that and sort of saying, look, just take it in. And it's okay to be frustrated and upset that you didn't get where you want to go. But then you have to really analyze what happened. You know, don't do the sort of superficial analysis, but dig in and say, from the big picture, what transpired here? And then get into the minute details, right? There are details where you might be able to pinpoint a specific interchange from your negotiation that sort of caused you to go down this road and to think that you might have been able to do something different. And by the way, let me just, the one thing I am very, very clear about early on in the book is this should be done devoid of blame. Blame serves absolutely no purpose. Blaming the other or blaming yourself doesn't help you to learn. In fact, it actually blocks you from learning, because it's a protective mechanism. And in fact, one of the chapters that I talk about is, why is it that we don't learn? So I spend a lot of time talking about the biases that we have, that we've surrounded ourselves with to protect us from admitting we've failed or that somehow this didn't go the way we wanted to. And after that, we get into coping. And, you know, I sort of try to utilize a little bit of the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross model of grief, because I do think that's what people feel, whether they, some people might say grief is a little bit strong, and that's okay. But I think it's also a helpful sort of way of just getting your head around it, that it's okay to grieve. Like, it means that something mattered a lot to you, right? And, you know, like I said, the analysis part, I think, is really important. But I also think the next two steps for me were kind of, as I was thinking this through, were sort of the ahas and in many ways where I think I have gotten tripped up. So the third step was really what we were talking about before, which is, you know, the lessons. And can you really take a lesson from this negotiation over here and apply it to this other one? Or are there parts of it that you can do that with, or what, right? But I think if we're a lot more discerning about the lessons, it's really valuable. And some of those, again, as well, from a psychological point of view, are rooted in our subconscious. And so actually borrow on the concept of transference from psychoanalysis, because there are some things that happen that are deeply embedded in us when things don't go well. And we have to not only deal with the behaviors and other kinds of things that get us into trouble, but also the mindset and maybe even how we learn to negotiate is getting in our way. And the fourth step for me is the one that I think, I hope will be most helpful for people, because basically what that step is all about is actively unlearning certain things. So usually what happens when we fail is that some weakness that we have in negotiation has played a role and gotten in the way. And, what I'm asking people to do is really examine those weaknesses and to actively unlearn, to say, here's a concept that I learned in terms of how to be a good negotiator. And I'm wondering and I'm questioning whether that's actually correct or not. And if it's not correct, how do I let it go and unlearn it and replace it with something different? And I'll give you a quick example of what I mean. One of the examples in the book that I use is compromise. You may know that I'm sort of not the biggest fan of compromise. I understand why it happens in negotiation, but I think that I see far too many people who suggest that compromise is synonymous with negotiation, that I'm going to have to give up something really important to me in order to reach an agreement, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I want people to think about is maybe that's not the best way to do this. There are times when perhaps you have to compromise because, you know, time is of the essence or things like that. But maybe what you can be doing is replacing compromise and the thought that that's what makes sort of the best negotiations and replace it with creativity and problem solving. And I think when you do that, you begin to say, okay, maybe there are some things that are holding me back here that fed into the reason I failed. And if I can unlearn some of those things and replace them with things that are a little better, then I think that might help me. And so that's, you know, I mean, and at the end of the book, like I talk quite a bit about the Japanese art of kintsugi. And I don't know if you know a whole lot about that, but what's really interesting about it is that it's the art of, if something breaks, instead of repairing it to the way that it used to look, the Japanese will use precious metals like gold and silver and platinum or whatever and emphasize the cracks so that you're owning the cracks and it becomes an added sort of dimension of the artwork. Of the beauty of the art is that the cracks are not only visible, but they tell a new story, a different story. And I think that, you know, if we could embrace that notion as negotiators, that we all have these cracks. So what do we do with them? Can we wear them on our sleeves and say, you know, I had a time where that didn't go so well, and here's what I really think I took away from that. And I think that's going to help me as I go forward, right? We have to become resilient because there's all kinds of setbacks and moves forwards. And I think if we have a way of imagining it, then it helps us.
Right. The five steps, aren't they amazing? Yes. I still have not gotten to the Japanese art of turning our cracks into gold yet in the book. But I would like to pick the point on lessons learned. As you know, a simple rule of logic, the implication implies that you know, we can learn from good examples, but we can also learn from bad examples. The question is how. Yes, it's easy to learn from good examples, right? Yeah. If someone shows us this is the way to do it, right? And we manage to do it exactly the way we do it, then we've learned that there's a good example, positive reinforcement. And that's kind of easy on our mind, yes, or easier on our mind, yes. Yeah. And the question is, how do we actually, or how can we go against our intuitive reactions to failure, mm-hmm. yes, and still learn from negative examples from those failures?
Yeah. Well, first thing is, I think, as you can gather from what I've been saying, a lot of this happens within your own mind. Right. So I think part of the question is, how do we see failure as not a problem, but like something that we can really, really learn from? In the short term, yes, it was painful. But in the longer term, how does it help us? And I think, you know, I think part of it is recognizing that to become an effective negotiator, it really comes down to, this is a journey. And if you're not, as you go through this, if you're not saying what happened here, why did it go this way, then you're really not going to learn anything new. You're just going to keep doing the same old, same old. And maybe you're getting decent results, but you're going to come up against challenges and problems. So I think part of it is how do you say, like, get your head around the idea that, okay, failure is part of this. And that's okay. Like, I'm not seeking it, but I'm also not going to run away from it when it does happen, right? So I think that's the first thing, is to sort of come to grips with that reality. You know, there's a great book by a woman named Maggie Jackson, who I had the opportunity to talk to related to my book, about, called Uncertainty. And she sort of turns the notion of uncertainty on its head. And she says, actually, people from a neurological point of view are far more predisposed to come up with good ideas when they are sitting with uncertainty. The problem is that too often, uncertainty has a very negative connotation. So we want to run away from it as fast as we can. She's like, if you can manage to sit with uncertainty, which, and I talk about this in the last chapter of the book, because we have to sit with uncertainty in negotiation. It's a big part of what we do. But just like uncertainty can make us nervous, unless we build confidence and skills and knowledge and things like that, so can failure. And, you know, there's, as I was doing some of this research around the book, I also came across a concept called intelligent failure, which I talk a little bit about. So there's a guy at Duke University's Fuqua Business School named Sim Sitkin, who wrote about intelligent failure in 1992, I believe. And what he was saying is, you know, there are a lot of companies and other organizations who are working on product development, and they expect to fail, right? Like, their first iterations are prototypes, if you will. And so they're always asking the question, so what did we learn from this, and how do we do it better next time? And I think part of the answer to your question, Remy, is that, which is, okay, how do we learn from this and do it better next time? And keep in mind the idea of intelligent design, that you know, that those failures lead to success. Now, in negotiation, we often talk about that, but we talk about it more as setbacks. Right. So if we, one of the best places to think about this is peace processes, right? So most peace processes go through many, many iterations and many efforts that fall apart. And then, but each one has a building block to it, where people learn from what happened, what's possible, what's not, et cetera. So that when they come at it, you know, they've had the benefit of those things that haven't worked out, and they've sort of looked back and said, what didn't work here? And I think that's how you can use this, is to say in a similar kind of way, all right, so this didn't work. Why not? Now, when I say getting back to the table, by the way, like, I mean it in two ways. There are some negotiations, and I have a sort of magnitude scale that I developed in the book from 1 to 4, right? 1 is a setback. 2 is more than a setback. 3 is, it's a really big setback. And 4, you just perhaps had a catastrophic failure and you're not going to get back to the table. So in that instance, with that sort of, you know, sort of spectrum, I talk about it as, in those first couple of scenarios, right? How do you get back to the table in that negotiation where it's still possible to get back there? Right. And in the last chapter, I talk a little bit about, all right, so you want to come back to the table now because you can see a different way forward, or you have some creative thoughts. Here's how do you re-engage? Right. But then on the last one, where you're not getting back to the table on this one, like, it got destroyed and it isn't happening, at least for the near term, for the very near term, or for the, you know, quite a long while. As a negotiator, you're going to go back to the table. Right? Maybe not in that instance, but you're going to go back to the table soon. So what do you learn from that as well? So there's two kind of ways that we get back to the table here. One is in a specific process, but the other is the big table of negotiation, and how you grow and develop as a negotiator is the other way of getting back to the table.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I'm looking right now on my other screen at the five steps, and especially at the following, the one which is following learning the right lessons, and that means unlearn weaknesses.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you have a hypothesis or a classification or some sort of a feeling, maybe? What kind of weaknesses are the most common sources of failures? Is that we need to unlearn in step four in order to be able to come back to the table, be it in a literal sense or in a more generic sense?
I mean, in so many ways, the kind of weaknesses we need to unlearn are the unexamined ones. And what I mean by that is that we just accept them. We take them for granted that this is the way you do things or this is how you learn them. And I share an example of a guy who learned to negotiate in a win-lose way. And so he brought that to every negotiation. Right now, we know that if you're going to negotiate with the same people over and over again, that's self-defeating behavior. And he was never discerning enough to say, when I have a one-off negotiation, this may be okay doing it this way. I can get more for myself, et cetera, but not in these other instances. And he never examined that because nobody ever said to him, you can't apply the same logic here because these dynamics are so different. So I think that, and it's interesting because I have a quote in the book that talks about, it's not experience that's the best teacher. It's examined experience. And there's a very big difference, right? Like we have to really examine our experience and say, what happened here? And not just sort of breeze past it. So I think it's those things that we assumed, we absorbed from different contexts. You know, if you ask people how they learn to negotiate, a lot of them say, well, you know, I had a boss this way, or I read it in some articles, or I read a book, or I this, that, and the other thing. And it doesn't go that deep. And that's not a criticism of people. It's just that it's more of a, okay, that's fine, but you should be asking yourself, does this always suit my purposes or not? And if not, you know, Peter Drucker talks about the whole idea of if you're going to unlearn, in order to learn something new, you have to unlearn something. Right? You're taking out something and replacing it with what? And I think for most of us, right, if we just take the essence of getting to yes, right, we unlearned that negotiation was focused on positions and we replaced it with getting to interests, right, and the importance of getting down underneath that. And I think that's a really good example of the kind of thing that we need to do. And the challenge is that each person has to do that for themselves. What you need to unlearn and what I need to unlearn are based on our experiences and based on the kind of things that we think form the core of our approach to negotiation. I mean, I ask that to a lot of people in my trainings and whatever, like, what's the core of your negotiation approach? Like, and people have a hard time defining that because they haven't really, and again, this isn't a criticism, but they haven't just really given it a lot of thought. They've just like, well, I always did it this way and I have some good successes, so I guess that's it. And I say, okay, could it be better? Like, are your deals as good as they could be? Or are you leaving value out there? And they're like, well, what does that mean? And so now we're examining and we're re-examining what this means.
Would that mean, Josh, a quick follow-up question, would that mean that we need an instructor, a coach, someone who helps us out understand that, if we discover those weaknesses, how do we fill in those gaps when we decide to unlearn them? Because we have to unlearn them with something else or replace them with something else. Yes. So which means that there's the moment we discover a reason for failure, doesn't it call for new content? Doesn't it call for a Josh Wise or Bill Urey or another great negotiation instructor or coach who helps us fill these mistakes or weaknesses with new, more effective negotiation content?
I mean, I certainly think that's going to be an important role of a teacher and a trainer or things like that. I mean, devoid of that, my hope is that when folks read the book, that they'll sort of say, well, if I don't believe that, like, what should I believe? Right.
Exactly.
And I have in that chapter about unlearning, I have a chart where I talk about a couple of different kinds of things that people might want to consider unlearning, like the idea of compromise or that we have to keep emotions out of negotiation. So I say, if this is what you think, why do you think it? Okay. And then if you think it's something you should unlearn, what do you need to unlearn? Like, why is compromise your strategy? How does it help you? Does it help you? And if it doesn't help you, like, what is it that you need to unlearn, right? And for example, in that instance, you need to unlearn that you always have to give something up in a negotiation in order to get somewhere, right? And so then you say, well, if I'm not giving something up, what am I doing, right?
Exactly.
And it means that I'm actually probing, right? I'm looking to underlying interests before I start giving, you know, starting to think about what I have to give up to get there, so that I make sure that I actually do have to give up something. Maybe I don't, because, you know, you and I know that when you get down to underlying interests, you realize that you don't actually have to give things up, you know. And that's one of the great things about, like, the cases in that book that I wrote a few years back. There's very little compromise in there because people were getting down to this level, right? So I'm hoping that the chart, but others will sort of use this and say, well, if I'm not going to do it that way, then how am I going to do it? And I think we have lots of answers for that. That's where the successes come in, right? That's where we can look at getting to yes and getting past no and never split the difference and all these books, right, that tell us what to do. But, like, are we listening? And importantly, are we getting rid of those other things that are part of this?
That make us inefficient, that make us stall, that make us run into impasses or, yes. Or close deals that we actually regret then closing, right?
Just the idea that there's still lots of people that think the purpose of negotiation is to reach agreement.
Yes.
If you unlearn that, and in the program that I teach with my students, they're like, that might be the most helpful thing that I have learned in this program, because all of a sudden now I've changed the bar with which and how I'm looking at negotiation. Before it was reach an agreement, right? But you and I know, Remy, it's not hard to reach agreement. I can give away all kinds of things to reach an agreement. So if you've changed that from reaching agreement to meeting my objective as best as possible, right? So you replaced that notion with this, you have a very different way of looking at negotiation. And I think you probably have a way of thinking about success and failure differently.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about step five now, right? So we've learned our lesson, looked back and sort of identified what happened, reflected upon our behavior and behavior of others. Then we identified the weaknesses, and in our humbleness, we looked around, how can we replace or what can we replace our weaknesses with? What is the high quality, what are the high quality science-based ideally recommendations that help me become more effective? Mm-hmm. But there is more to it, I think. There is also a necessity to bring in or to somehow demonstrate resilience, right? Because all of everything that we've talked about is now very intellectual.
Yeah.
Right. But at the end of the day, I have to make a decision to confront myself with another negotiation situation, or maybe a similar negotiation situation, with the same partner, where I have a luggage, right, with me of past, let's say, suboptimal performance, maybe, to put it generically. So are there any ways to somehow build up this resilience so that we can indeed return to the table, you know, the one in a literal sense, but also in a more general sense?
Well, I would actually argue that this process that I'm laying out is actually trying to make you a resilient negotiator. The whole process itself is saying, you're going to fall down. You're going to get knocked down. Are you going to get up? And if you're going to get up, how are you going to get back up? And part of the answer is these steps in the process. But here's one thing that's important. And I try to touch on it in the last chapter about confidence. So none of us is always confident all the time in negotiation, we're confident when we know the subject matter, when we're in a place where the negotiation's going the way we imagined it might, or whatever, right? But confidence ebbs and flows. And I think confidence is, in order to be as confident as you can, you have to be knowledgeable, right, about negotiation in general. Then you have to sort of think through the ins and outs of this negotiation, what you know. But this is also where I think uncertainty and flexibility and adaptability come in. And in fact, in the book, I ended up talking to a friend of mine who teaches improv to you know, to leaders and negotiators and people who deal with conflict. Now, there are plenty of people who have talked about improv as an important skill for negotiation. But I really think because of the fact that we're always dealing with incomplete information and we're sitting with this uncertainty, if you take these pieces together, right, then you say, okay, let me try to relearn a little bit about uncertainty, meaning let me be open to the fact that maybe I can sit here with this, right? Typically with uncertainty, it's the old adage is tell me yes, tell me no, but tell me something, right? But what I'm in part saying to folks is sit with not knowing. And that's not easy. I never said it was, and I'm not proclaiming it is now. But what I am saying is if you can learn to say, okay, maybe there's a solution that we haven't thought about. And can I adapt to what I'm learning through this process? Can I take it in, et cetera? Then I'm grounding myself in that. And I'm becoming more and more resilient to be able to then go back to you as the other negotiator, for example. Like, let's say we were in the magnitude of 1 to 3, right, on the scale where we decide we're going to re-engage with this other negotiator and try to get back to the table. Part of that is going to require you to probably take that first step, unless you get lucky and the other side reaches out and says, hey, I'd like to try to talk again. And, you know, I could hear in the back of my head people saying, well, what if I'm dealing with somebody who's been a real pain in the neck? Why should I reach out to them? And I try to rely on Nelson Mandela, who sat in prison for 27 years and reached out to Frederick de Klerk when he got out and said, we need to sort this through. And I say, basically, right, there you go. If he can do it, you can shrug off the insults or the challenges that arose in your negotiation and knock on the door first. And, you know, look, I think we all know that in negotiation and in life, like, we can't control the other person. All we can control is ourselves and what we do and how we approach things. And so I think in this particular case, here's an instance where I can see clearly why it would be beneficial for me to revive these talks. I'm going to take the initiative, and I'll, you know, and that's how this is going to have to transpire. But for me, you know, when I talk to people about, if you think about the process that we just went through of coping, like really coping with the fact that you didn't get what you want, right? And then really trying to figure out why did this happen? And then what can I learn? And is that the right lesson? And if it's the right lesson, what got me in trouble here? And what do I unlearn? Like, all of that becomes a way that you remake yourself into a better negotiator. And you might use the term, you become more resilient as a result. Like, we don't become resilient, right? If we go back to the very beginning of our conversation, we don't become resilient thanks to our successes. We become resilient because someone knocked us down and we didn't get where we wanted to go. So the whole thing, and it was interesting because when I canvassed a number of people, and almost all of my students said, you should have resilience in the title. And all of the professional people said, don't put resilience in the title. It's like, it's too much of a catchphrase. So I didn't, I listened to them. But if you read the book, it's hard to sort of come away without sort of feeling like, okay, like, this is definitely about me becoming more resilient. I hope so. I mean, that was the message that underpinned all of this was, we're not just talking about failure. We're talking about failure so that you can grow, become better, and succeed at some point and eventually in the future.
That makes a lot of sense. So basically the message is, climbing the steps makes us resilient, right? It's not the last step. It's the fact of getting the exercise as we get to the last step. this exercise, this strength that comes from the intellectual recommendations that you're actually making as we you know, accept it, analyze, unlearn, and learn the light lesson and unlearn weaknesses, right? That makes us stronger and more confident to take, to make the next steps and reach out, reach out to our negotiation partners.
I also, like, to me, I don't want this. I'm hoping that people won't just take this as an intellectual exercise, because it's not. Like, it should be grounded and rooted in your negotiations, like really examining what transpired here so that you can sort of figure out how to do this better and differently.
Yes, maybe not intellectual, analytical. That's what I meant.
Right. Yeah, but it's, either way, it's fine. I mean, I think you have to start by, and I think this process is heavily focused on you.
And correct.
And that's very hard to do. Like, I make no bones about the fact that I'm asking people to turn the mirror on them. You know, as you mentioned, my colleague Bill Yuri, you know, wrote Getting TS, but then many years later, he wrote a book called Getting TS with Yourself.
Correct.
And, you know, I think when I've ever used any of that and talked to people about it, they're like, this is difficult. I'm like, absolutely. This is harder than anything else that you're going to do, because it requires you to look in the mirror and say, am I really doing all of these things, or can I do things a bit better, differently, et cetera?
Yeah, it requires being reflective and critical at the same time. And each of these components is difficult enough, right?
With the purpose of getting better, right? It's one thing to be critical of yourself and then you never want to do this again. That's definitely not the idea. The idea is be critical, be your own worst critic, but don't beat yourself up. Like, do it so that you can say, ah, I think I can see how if I just change my view of the goal of negotiation from reaching agreement to meeting my objective, I can see how that would help me and would be beneficial. So maybe I should try that in my next negotiation. That's what I'm, you know, wanting people to get at.
So it's not just reflective without the purpose or being critical without the purpose. It's both with a purpose of becoming a better negotiator, avoiding failures or learning more from out of the failures that we've just gone through.
That's right.
There's, I have to blend it in. I think Carolyn has already shared a few comments. She definitely appreciates the recommendation of introducing improv into her training, but also as a part of the 5-step process, right? Becoming more resilient, right? Becoming more flexible and more adaptable. That's, I think, the connection, right? What would you say, Josh?
Well, I would say that. And I think, listen, I know lots of, one of the things I try to help my students to understand is having a plan is fool's gold, as we would say, because negotiations are not that predictable. And so you have to learn, and you have to learn to be adaptable and to be flexible. And that's what this all is, right? Is training your mind to kind of go into this and say, okay, there are certain things that I know I don't know about this negotiation. That's how you should be going into your negotiations. Like, I know certain things, I can prep and I can know a good bit, right? But there are definitely things that are going to arise that I can't know right now. And the only way I can manage that is, you know, is to learn to be flexible and to take in new information. I often call that the freak out factor for my students, where, you know, they think they've got it all laid out. And then someone says, yeah, but we can't do that unless we do this. And they're like, oh my God, I didn't even think of that. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh no, this whole thing's going to fall apart in front of me. I better just agree. I'm like, whoa, hold on, slow down. Like, do you see what just happened there? You went in with a false sense of security. And so you have to expect the unexpected as part of these processes. And I think that, you know, and I've had students say to me, I just can't think quickly on my feet. And I say, I understand, but you have to learn how to. So we're going to unlearn the things you tell me. Why is it so hard for you? Well, you know, I grew up in a family that, oh, you know, we were big planners. Like, we didn't do anything without planning. Okay. But this isn't your family. So we're going to have to work on that and say, how can we get you comfortable? And then we're going to try it out, right? We're going to use the cases and simulations and lots of other things that have been developed in this field to help remake somebody who doesn't think they're capable of doing this into somebody that is capable. Again, you know, all of these are learned behaviors.
Correct. Correct. They are. And cognitive flexibility is a phenomenon that is trainable and learnable. And this is exactly the meta competency or meta skill that improv theater or improv exercises are addressing, right? They help us connect the neurons. They help us build new connections. And cognitive flexibility can be trained. And this, when it's trained, it's very useful to cope also with, let's say, coming up with new ideas, how to rebuild the building or refill the void that is being created when we decide to unlearn a weakness. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. We're slowly approaching the end of our conversation. Let's focus on the marketing message. I know the book, at least here in Europe, will be out only in February.
Yeah.
And the publishing date I've checked, I think, is February.
Yeah, February 11th. Yep.
February 11th, right? Exactly. So if you were to summarize this book in one catchy sentence, one message, what would it be, Josh?
That failure is part of the landscape of negotiation. And if you want to be the best negotiator that you can be, you're going to learn to handle it. You're not going to run from it. You're not going to be debilitated from it. You're going to say, okay, this happened. I'm not thrilled, but there's something in here for me to know so that I can be the best negotiator that I need to be.
Wow, that's a very powerful message. Let me add maybe one more, which is implicitly there. This is how I think you start the book. Yes, we as negotiation professors, coaches, authors, we tend to oversell success. Yes, so having read started reading your book, not having read it entirely, but having started reading your book, Josh, I think what comes to my mind is, hey, let's be suspicious about all those out there who promise unlimited success in negotiation and a Midas touch, right? Negotiation touch in terms of turning everything into gold whenever we sit down at the negotiating table. It just does not work like that.
You know, I think analogously, when people used to think about leaders, they used to think that the best leaders were the most charismatic leaders. But I would actually challenge that notion. And there are lots of people who have, like Jim Collins and others. And sometimes when I see charismatic leaders, they make me very suspicious because usually there's not a lot of substance beneath the charisma. And I think it's probably an appropriate analogy of how our thinking is evolved and changed when it comes to leadership and how it can do so here.
Yes, there are also concepts of servant leadership and transformative leadership, right? Where leaders deliberately step down and say, well, I don't know everything. Yes, I can fail, but my role is to help you succeed, right?
That's
help
right.
you utilize your talents, your skills, and your experience. Josh, I always ask this question to all my guests, and it's about greatness in negotiation. So this is going to be my last question today.
Okay.
When you think about great negotiators, be it contemporary or historical, is there a particular character or a few characters that immediately pop up in your mind?
I don't know if it's characters. Do you mean like individuals or are
there individuals? Yes, individuals. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there are, but I also I tend to think about, you know, I've had the pleasure of going to the Program on Negotiation as a Great Negotiator series. And one of the things that always struck me about that, and when we would listen to people, is there's definitely a sort of being reflective and thinking a lot about what's happening and the ability to sort of not only be humble, but to sort of step back at times when you're in the throes of something and when it looks like it's not possible, finding a way forward. You know, I remember Lakhdar Brahimi, the Algerian mediator who's worked on some of the most difficult conflicts. And he said, you know, you have to be humble enough to approach a problem with a lot of respect. I'm paraphrasing, right? But you also have to believe enough in yourself to think that you can do what other people haven't. And to me, when I listen to people, I think that the vast majority of people who I know who are amazing negotiators, great negotiators, they have that mindset that there's a humility to them, but there's also a stick-to-itiveness, a deep desire to find a way forward, and that there's a resilience and a relentlessness to not quit as part of that process. So that's what comes to mind.
Yes, and that probably also the ability to cope with failure, or let's say to build in the failure onto the path to greatness, right? Okay. Which they certainly must have done it in order to be able to get to that message, to combine humbleness with confidence, right? Humbleness with respect, I might not know certain things, I might not be able to do certain things, but also with confidence that, hey, I've experienced failure and success in the past so frequently that I feel strong about my ability to help resolve a certain conflict, certain issue.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Josh, it's been a pleasure. It's been a blast. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with our viewers and listeners. Guys, be on the lookout. Josh's book is out it's called Getting Back to the Table, 5 Steps to Reviving Stalled Negotiations. And it will be out in February 2025. So I'm sure you will hear Josh speaking about it on one or the other podcast from now on. And please support him in his message. Make sure you buy the book when it's out there. We will post the link to, I think Amazon already has a website for the book, and I'm sure the publisher does as well. Post the link under our podcast. Josh, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for joining us today. And until next time on the podcast on negotiation.
Thank you, Remy.